Barrow, and welcome to Volume 44, Number 39 of Grapevine, your weekly local news magazine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday, the 27th of September, 2024. I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by newsreaders Andrew and Alison. And in the news this week, road workers are hoping for a dry winter, school ceilings are being scrutinised, and believe it or not, teaspoons are born on the Broads. All this coming your way during the next hour and a half, plus the results of some mountain climbing we previewed earlier in the year. First, though, we have a birthday. Yes, it's very many happy returns to Stephen Miller for this coming Sunday, the 29th. Have a great day, Stephen. It's time for the first part of the news, so over to Alison and Andrew, followed very closely by a mini harvest celebration.
Hello everybody and welcome to another week of Grapevine, with news and stories from around your area. My usual co-reader Alison is here with me again. Morning Alison.
Good morning everybody.
And she'll have another interesting topical feature for you. But first, let's start with some news. And a Norfolk firm that went bust owes businesses more than £6 million after going into administration. Specialised Management Services, SMS Alderley, a manufacturer and service provider for the oil and gas industry, which is based in Goulston, went into administration in July. Now it's been revealed that the firm went under, owing creditors more than £6 million. Unsecured creditors include local firms like S&G Fabrications in Lowestoft, which is owed £250,000. SMS entered administration on July the 24th, leading to 87 redundancies. This was 95% of its workforce, with five employees being retained to assist administrators Grant Thornton. The Joint Administrator's Statement of Proposals for Alderley PLC, Alderley Systems Limited and SMS, all part of the Alderley Group, estimated former SMS employees are owed more than £164,000. Under ordinary preferential creditors, this figure includes employee wages and salary up to £800 per person, and accrued holiday pay and contributions to occupational pension schemes deducted in the 4 months prior to the insolvency. Secondary preferential creditor claims, which may include HMRC claims for arrears of VAT, sums deducted in respect of PAYE and employees' national insurance contributions, were estimated to be worth more than £402,000. The report, published on Companies House, revealed an offer was made for SMS 2 days before the firm entered administration, but was later withdrawn. In June, the board of Alderley and its subsidiaries contacted Grant Thornton about growing cash pressure within the group. Grant Thornton was engaged to undertake an accelerated merger and acquisition of the three businesses in the group, including SMS itself. On July the 19th, directors issued notices of intention to appoint administrators. The offer for SMS was sent directly to the board on July the 22nd, outside of the accelerated merger and acquisition process. The party making the offer declined a request to provide funding to meet payroll costs and delay the administration while a solvent sale was explored. The joint administrators, once appointed, continued a dialogue with the offerer, but no feasible offer was received. Formed in 1999, SMS manufactured equipment and provided maintenance and installation services for the oil and gas industry, specialising in hydraulic, pneumatic and electrical control systems. The company was based at Starling House, a two-storey office and warehouse at Galston's Beacon Park. The joint administrators have now instructed Savills estate agents to market and sell Starling House, which the agent has listed with a guide price of £2.5 million. The book value of SMS's plant and machinery is £131,000. The value of SMS's debtors at the time of the appointment of the joint administrators was around £5 million, and to date, realisations of around £2 million have been achieved. SMS was acquired by its parent company, Alderley PLC, based in Gloucestershire in 2003. Both Alderley PLC and Alderley Systems Limited entered administration alongside SMS on July the 24th. The Alderley Group was founded in 1989 by Bristol businessman Tony Shepherd, who named the business after his home village. Mr. Shepherd died in 2020. Alderley had bases in the UK, India, Saudi Arabia, Singapore, the United Arab Emirates and Qatar. Estimated unsecured creditors for Alderley PLC and Alderley Systems Limited are £8.89 million and £4.19 million respectively. The administrations are currently due to end on July the 23rd, 2025. The administrator's first progress report will cover 6 months from the date of the administration, which will be delivered to creditors within 1 month thereafter. It is currently anticipated that secure creditors will be repaid in full and that there will be sufficient funds to enable a distribution for the unsecured creditors of both SMS and Alderley Systems Limited, but not Alderley PLC. And the decision date for creditors' approval is October the 1st.
More than a fifth of callers to Norfolk Constabulary's 101 service give up because they take so long to answer, a new report has found. The figures are revealed in the force's annual inspection report, which said it required improvement in the way responded to the public. The high number of abandoned 101 calls, four times higher than the national guidance, meant that more people then made inappropriate 999 calls. The report, carried out by HM Inspectorate of Constabulary and Fire and Rescue Services, warned that the force's slow responses to public calls meant it risked failing to safeguard victims or collect evidence. The watchdog said that out of 82 cases it examined, only 49 cases had a response within the required time. Delayed responses can lead to the constabulary missing opportunities to safeguard victims or collect evidence, it said. Roy Wilshire, HM Inspector of Constabulary, said, "I have some concerns about how the constabulary is responding to the public. In particular, it needs to improve how long it takes to respond to incidents at all levels." The report said the number of abandoned 101 calls meant the force had a, quote, "degree of risk that isn't understood or addressed, as the content of any abandoned call and the risk it may have contained is unknown." Inspectors said the constabulary also needs to improve protection of vulnerable members of the public and the way it manages offenders. It said important information about victims isn't always being shared with other agencies, and there is insufficient oversight of standard risk domestic abuse cases. However, inspectors rated the force outstanding for recording crimes, good for crime prevention, and adequate for investigating crime. Since our last inspection, the constabulary has made a significant effort to review and improve its investigative standards, said Mr. Wilshire. Chief Constable Paul Sanford said, "This report highlights the constabulary has many strengths, including preventing and deterring crime, while also having an effective neighbourhood policing offer, which understands and responds to the needs of local communities." He said the force had made significant investment in its control room since 2021, to improve call handling and response time. The inspectorate's report states that we should be investing in better technology to help us to manage non-emergency calls, and I firmly agree with this. Next month, we hope to start a pilot of new technology to assist us with some calls for service, and we believe that this will lead to improvements, he added.
Highway chiefs say work to dual two sections of the A47 in Norfolk is going well, but a dry winter will be crucial to maintain the good progress. Long-awaited work to dual the road between Blowfield and North Burlingham and from Easton to North Tuddenham finally got underway this summer, and bosses from National Highways, the government company responsible for the work, say they are making really good progress on the project. Chris Griffin, the A47 programme leader for National Highways, said work to reroute utilities pipes on the Blowfield to North Burlingham section was drawing to a close. He said work would begin in the autumn to put in the piling necessary for new structures along the route, such as a new bridge over the A47 to connect the villages of Blowfield and North Burlingham. The work will see 1.5 miles of the road dualled and will cost about £100 million. Mr. Griffin said piling work is also ongoing on the section between Easton and North Tuddenham, where 5.5 miles is being dualled at a cost of up to £250 million. He said vegetation on that section had been cleared and new tanks installed near Honingham to prevent flooding, an issue which closed the road a number of times last winter. He said we're making really good progress. All is looking very good. We just need a nice dry winter and we will see the scheme progressing very well. National Highways started the main dualling work, which is due to continue until 2026, even into 2027, on both sections of the A47 in August this year. Before that, the organisation was limited to preparatory work because of a legal challenge against the government's decision to grant permission for the work. Eco-campaigner Dr. Andrew Boswell, a former city and county councillor, had taken the matter to the High Court and the Court of Appeal. You may remember we covered that story several times. But his argument that the government had acted unlawfully in granting permission for the A47 schemes because the cumulative environmental impact had not been properly considered was finally dismissed.
The leader of Norfolk County Council is to meet a government minister to try to salvage the scrapped £600 million devolution deal for the county. But senior Conservatives said they are not prepared to, quote, get into bed with Suffolk over a revised deal. At an often tetchy county hall meeting, leader Kay Mason-Billig came under fire for her aggressive tone over how she intends to conduct talks with local government minister Jim McMahon. Mrs. Mason-Billig said the Labour government had crushed the Norfolk deal, which would have included an investment fund of £20 million a year for 30 years, control of the £12 million budget for adult education, and £7 million to kickstart housing on brownfield sites. The new government pulled the plug on the deal, which would have featured a directly elected county council leader, saying it preferred a mayoral model separate from the council. But Mrs. Mason-Billig said, "This government has dismissed us as if we were nobodies. They see us as unimportant, and as a consequence they do not want to invest in us." Mrs. Mason-Billig said after long being ghosted in attempts to speak to ministers, she would now be meeting Mr. McMahon in October. She said, "I will listen to the minister's concerns and try to understand why he refused us this. I will do what I can to persuade him to salvage whatever I can from the deal. But I will caution him that Norfolk people will not forgive this government if they do not invest in their future and give us devolution." Terry Jeremy, Labour County Councillor and South West Norfolk MP, criticised Mrs. Mason-Billig's aggressive tone, while Labour group leader Steve Morphew said such an approach would get nowhere. There have been suggestions the government might look more kindly on a joint deal with Suffolk, but Liberal Democrat County Councillor and North Norfolk MP Stefan Aquarone said that would be disastrous. Conservative County Councillor Carl Smith, leader of Great Yarmouth Borough Council, agreed. "We shouldn't get into bed with Suffolk. They don't want to get into bed with us, so they have told us." A previously proposed Norfolk-Suffolk deal with a single mayor collapsed in 2016.
And staying with the County Hall topics, the County Hall leader has claimed Norfolk is under attack from solar farm developers after a series of applications were put in to cover thousands of acres of farmland in panels. Kay Mason-Billig described the plans as deeply disturbing and a creeping abuse of the countryside and said the county should resist them. Norfolk County Council's Conservative leader was speaking after energy companies unveiled separate plans to create the UK's largest two solar farms in Norfolk. One, called Highgrove, would cover 4,000 acres of land on five sites close to Dereham and Swaffham on either side of the A47. The second, East Pye, would cover 2,700 acres on 34 fields surrounding several villages close to the A140 near Long Stratton. If they go ahead, Highgrove would be nearly 16 times larger than the current biggest, while East Pye would be 6 times larger. Their backers believe the solar farms are a vital part of the UK's effort to meet its highly ambitious net zero targets. But the proposals have already drawn strong criticism, with fears raised about the loss of farmland, as well as the cost and efficiency of the sites. Mrs. Mason-Billig announced her opposition at a meeting of Norfolk County Council on Tuesday. She said, "It's something I think we should all be worried about, the deeply disturbing plethora of applications for so-called solar farms. I do not call them farms because they are anything but that. What they are is taking up valuable agricultural land which should be used for food production. Local councils will not be able to block the two Norfolk projects because they are deemed nationally significant infrastructure projects, so we'll bypass the usual planning process, with Ed Miliband, Secretary of State for the Department of Energy Security and Net Zero, having the ultimate say." Mrs. Mason-Billig said this meant local people were being denied a say. Mrs. Mason-Billig, whose administration wants to build the 3.9 million Norwich Western Link Road over the Wensum Valley, said the solar farms would be eyesores which would destroy wildlife habitats. She represents Loddon, and she said, "I applaud the efforts of parish councils to fight this creeping abuse of our landscape. I will certainly be supporting my parishes, many of whom will be affected, in resisting this latest attack on our county. Norfolk is not a place to be exploited by the government in its efforts to feed the power-hungry South East, especially when local people will not even benefit from it." She likened the applications to controversial proposals for pylons stretching from near Norwich to Tilbury, where power from offshore Norfolk wind farms would be transferred to the southeast of the country. She said, "This is another example of how the government doesn't care about Norfolk. They will happily rape us of our commodities, but give us nothing in return. I, for one, am not going to stand for it, and I hope the rest of the council will support me in this." Earlier this month, Mr. Miliband said solar power was crucial to hitting net zero targets. He declared his intention to push ahead with onshore wind farms and solar farms where possible. RWE, the firm developing Highgrove, has launched its initial consultation into its projects. Mike Greslow, the project manager, said, "We understand the importance of community consultation, as only by working with local people can we ensure the best scheme is delivered." Developers Island Green Power, who are behind the plans for the East Pye solar farm near the A140, say it will power hundreds of thousands of homes and play a key role in helping the UK hit the ambitious net zero targets. It said wildlife enhancement measures would be considered, and said it would be looking for suggestions from the local community when it launches consultation later this year. Parish councils in the area have already voiced their opposition to the huge scheme, which will stretch over a distance of more than 10 miles and cover around 8 villages. David Hook, chairman of Hemphill Parish Council, said, "The sheer size and transformative nature of this project would completely destroy the area."
Police have warned young drivers that they are not invincible as they start a crackdown on driving offences. The warning comes as part of a campaign to crack down on crimes such as speeding, drink driving, using a phone while driving and not wearing a seatbelt, all targeted at younger drivers. Research has shown that in the county's most serious crashes, 37% of them involved a driver under 29 years old. Chief Inspector Vicky McParkland of the Joint Roads and Armed Policing Team said, "Getting your driving licence or riding a moped for the first time is really exciting. It is one of your first experiences of freedom and is something we all look forward to. It is critical that you start good habits from day one behind the wheel. Driving is a privilege. You are not invincible. He continued, it is your responsibility to look after yourself, your passengers and other road users. I do not want my officers knocking on your loved one's door to tell them that you haven't made it home safely. As part of the campaign, the force will use proactive patrols, unmarked police cars and motorcyclists from the Road Casualty Reduction Team. Norfolk's Police and Crime Commissioner Sarah Taylor added, living in a predominantly rural county means that having the ability to drive at a young age is very important for work and leisure and gives young people more independence. With that freedom comes the huge responsibility to consider other road users and to adhere to the law. Younger drivers don't have the benefit of having the years of driving experience that is often needed to be able to preempt other people's behaviour and take action to avoid it. This can be made even more difficult if that driver is distracted by their phone or driving too fast.
Major dredging works could take place as part of a £25 million project to put Great Yarmouth at the forefront of the renewable energy sector. New plans lodged by Norfolk County Council with the Marine Management Organisation outline that a stretch of the river near South Deans will have roughly 1,500 tonnes dug from the riverbed. The dredging work is related to the construction on the South Deans Peninsula of a £25 million offshore energy campus. It is expected that larger drafted vessels, up to 90 metres in stature, will be able to pass through more easily once the work is complete. The larger boats will normally be carrying staff and supplies for the maintenance of wind turbines. As per the plans, the extracted sediment would then be deposited out at sea, dependent on test results to ensure the dredged material will not cause harm to marine life. Great Yarmouth is already home to some of the country's largest developers and the operational and maintenance bases for their wind farms. It is hoped that redeveloping this part of the South Deans Peninsula will capitalise on the East Coast's offshore renewables sector and the enterprise zone that covers sites in Great Yarmouth and Lowestoft, creating a significant economic opportunity. Councillor Fabian Eagle, Norfolk County Council's Cabinet Member for Economic Growth, said, "The offshore energy sector provides Great Yarmouth and Norfolk with arguably the single most important economic opportunity for a generation. Oil and gas has been a mainstay of the local economy for over 50 years, and the recent emergence of offshore renewables has presented Great Yarmouth Port and its supply chain and its skills base with a chance of enjoying hugely significant growth and investment once more. The potential of this site to enhance our regional economy has been widely recognised, and its delivery, alongside the direct port access provided by the new Herring Bridge, will enable us to realise these benefits as quickly as possible."
Well, it's that time of the year when we notice the harvest in the field, so I thought I'd do a little bit of research and come up with a short feature about the harvest. The name harvest comes from an old English word, harvest, meaning autumn, which, as we know, is the season for gathering the food of the land. The success of the annual harvest was literally a matter of life and death, as a good harvest would provide food during the barren winter months. A good harvest was a time for celebration, and there were many superstitions surrounding this time of the year. At the same time, the local church played a large part in harvest Thanksgiving celebrations. Roaming groups of labourers would seek employment from farms at the beginning of the harvest season. In some parts of Norfolk, they would drag their sickles along the floor to announce their arrival. Then a Lord of the Harvest would be appointed, who was in charge of negotiating rates and conditions of labour. Leading his workers, or reapers, as they scythed the fields, he would be served the first at meal times. The corn harvest began in early August, a few weeks later than is usual now, and was just after the hay had been gathered in early summer. This made for a few very busy weeks for everyone on the farm, and beyond the farm too, for the workload was greater than the regular labour force could manage. Every available man, woman and child was needed to get the crop in. Farmers in the arable districts worried that they wouldn't have enough labourers as harvest approached, and there always seemed to be shortages. About a million regular farm workers were employed in England and Wales in the mid-19th century. But numbers swelled during harvest, especially in East Anglia. To augment their regular workers, farmers turned to any able-bodied person. The village wives were recruited, whilst boys and girls who were still at school were usually taken on at fixed wages. They had various jobs. They carried the elevenses and fourses, the men's snacks, at 11 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon, into the fields. Some of the boys would lead the wagon horses, and both boys and girls would be employed as bind pullers. The bind puller worked with a tyer up, the man or the woman who came after the reaper and tied the corn into sheaves. There were all sorts of casual and migrant workers, tramps, gypsies, and especially Irish people. People used to come out from the towns to help as well, but by the 1860s, the Industrial Revolution had reduced that supply of workers. The hop harvest in Kent was the last survival of this practice, continuing into the 20th century. Sheaves were gathered into stooks, between 6 and 10 sheaves, leaning against each other to allow drying air to flow through. Styles of stook varied across the country according to local customs. It was back-breaking work, with all the leaning and stooping into the cutting and bending to gather up the sheaves. In hot weather, it was dry, sweaty and dusty. In wet or changeable weather, trying to cut the laid crops was difficult and more taxing. The language among the workers was, wrote Richard Jefferies, a contemporary writer, not that of pastoral poetry. The harvesters worked from 5 a.m. till dusk, but the compensation was the extra pay. A regular farm labourer earning 10 to 12 shillings a week, typical of large parts of central and southern England, could get up to £1 a week at harvest time, and there might also be a bonus payment at the end. In addition, his midday meal was usually provided, plus all the beer or cider needed to keep him going through a hot day. Casual and migrant workers were paid at similar rates in deals struck with the farmer. Some were at piece rates, cutting and tying wheat at 12 shillings an acre, for example. After the stooks were dried, the crop was carted to the stackyard. Most of the migrant harvesters had gone by this stage, but the work of loading the wagons and building the stacks continued to draw on local labour beyond the regular men. It was all manual work still. The first machines to lift hay and straw into a stack were introduced in 1863. It was hard work for the horses as well, hauling the heavily laden wagons. After the harvest came the celebration, Harvest Home, called Hawkey in some places. Everyone in the village joined in the harvest festival. Sometimes these celebrations got rather out of hand, which led some in the church to think they should be stopped. However, following the example of a vicar of a church in Cornwall, the Reverend Dr. William Beale, rector of Brook in Norfolk, was the first to hold a harvest festival in Norfolk in 1854. He said his aim was to put a stop to the disgraceful scenes which too often characterise the close of harvest, and to the system of largesse which gives rise to cases of the grossest description. Likewise, on the 18th of September 1855, a harvest home celebration took place in the village of Banham in Norfolk, in the form of a public tea meeting held on the green. Ministers of various denominations addressed those attending, chaired by the Right Honourable the Earl of Albemarle. The tea meeting was to be a celebration without the need for alcohol, part of his task to reform the manners of the eastern counties. Nowadays, many churches and communities still celebrate the bringing in of the harvest. Harvest Festival is celebrated on the Sunday closest to the harvest moon, which this year was on the 18th of September, and which marks the start of autumn.
I drove my tractor through your haystack last night. I threw me pitchfork at your dog to keep quiet. Now something's telling me that you'm avoiding me. And perfect harmony. I got 20 acres and pity. She made I laugh. I'll stick by you, I'll give you all that you need. We'll have twins and triplets, I'm a man built for speed. And you know I'll love you, darling, so give me your hand. Kitchen, it's a proper disgrace. Now if I cleaned it up, would you change your mind? I'll give up drinking Strumpy and that larder of lime. Cause I got a brand new combine harvester and I'll give you the key. Come on now, let's get together in perfect harmony. Grand couple at that last words of dance. I wore brand new gaiters and me corduroy pants. In your new Sunday dress with your perfume smelling grand. We had our photos taken us old in hand. Now I ain't got a brand new combine harvester and I'll give you the key. Now that we both passed our 50s, I think that you and me should stop this. And will you marry me? Cause I ain't got a brand new combine harvester and I'll give you the key. Mar, you're a fine looking woman and I can't wait to get me hands on your land.
Well, who else but the Wurzels there and their combine harvester. Right, more news coming up from Andrew and Alison, which will be followed by some rather different Vision Norfolk news.
Rare spoonbill have bred for a second year running at Norfolk Wildlife Trust's Hickling Broad and Marshes, providing hope of a future colony of these distinctive birds, says Reserves Officer Robert Morgan. Last year, NWT's Hickling Broad and Marshes, his workplace, hosted the first breeding spoonbill in the Norfolk Broads for 400 years. This year, two pairs bred again, raising an amazing five fledglings between them. At the time of writing, all the adults and offspring can be seen, sometimes at close quarters, on Brendan's Marsh. It is hoped that they will remain until the end of September. They will eventually head south, with Poole Harbour being a key wintering site for Norfolk's small but growing spoonbill population. Even to the newly acquainted, they are easy to spot, being tall, creamy white birds with long necks and long legs. But their most distinctive feature is their elongated, spatula-shaped bill. Although heron-like in appearance, they belong to the ibis family, holding their neck and legs straight out when in flight. Spoonbill fledglings, known affectionately as teaspoons on account of their shorter bills, can be identified by the black in their wingtips. Spoonbill are nearly always associated with wetlands, where they are often seen sweeping their strange spoonbills from side to side in shallow water. They use this method to siphon their food of small fish, crustaceans and mollusks. Historically, the spoonbill was a regular nesting bird in southern Britain, visiting in summer and departing south for winter, with records of birds nesting in East Anglia as far back as the 1300s. However, due to drainage, eggs and chicks were being taken for food and general persecution. The spoonbill was already in serious decline by the 1600s, and in the mid-1700s, the last spoonbills were nesting in Britain. For more than 400 years, not a single teaspoon was raised in Britain. During the 20th century, the bird was a rare but regular passage migrant, with some wintering on estuaries in southwest England. The population started to expand in the lowlands of Holland, and the Dutch population increased to over 500 pairs by 1995. Visits to the UK by spoonbill became more regular, and in 2010 a small colony became firmly established at Holcombe National Nature Reserve in Norfolk. Spoonbill are also regularly seen at Norfolk Wildlife Trust's Clye and Salthouse marshes, where recently a number of nests were found in nearby private woodland. The arrival of breeding spoonbill in the Broads marks a significant milestone in the bird's expansion and a tribute to the habitat improvement work NWT has carried out at Hickling. It is hoped that this is the start of a much larger colony of this wonderful bird. NWT Senior Reserves Assistant for Broads North, Robert Smith, is from a generation that's in the habit of seeing three species of egret in Norfolk, even breeding bee-eaters, none of which appeared in the Observer's Book of Birds. But the appearance of breeding spoonbill was met, nonetheless, with delight and excitement. It is so wonderful to see spoonbill fledglings again at Brendan's Marsh. It shows that work to enhance the habitats on our reserves and across Norfolk is hugely important to the survival of our wildlife, including birds such as the spoonbill, he said. But as Rob explains, it is not just spoonbill that have benefited from the extensive work that has been carried out at NWT's Hickling Broad. He added, the mix of shallows to deeper water means there is a diversity of invertebrate and small fish for food, and the mix of islands, dikes and various vegetation creates a mosaic of wetland habitats ideal for a wide range of species, not just spoonbill. At this time of year, birds such as ruff, snipe and green sandpiper can also be seen on the marsh, as well as a good mix of wildfowl. If you're quick, you may be lucky enough to find a spoonbill at NWT Hickling Broad and Marshes, or perhaps NWT Clye and Salthouse Marshes, before they depart south.
And we continue on an avian theme, but sadly not quite as encouraging. The RSPCA is still appealing for information after a suspicious number of dead gulls were found on an industrial estate in Yarmouth in August. The gulls' bodies had been put in a skip and had been found either on the ground or on top of a warehouse roof in Halfridge Road. A spokesperson for the RSPCA said, "We are still appealing for information after a suspicious number of dead gulls have been found on the industrial estate. A preliminary post-mortem was carried out on a bird and it was discovered that the gull had been shot five times with what was believed to have been an air gun. Sadly, the remaining gulls' bodies were too decomposed to establish a cause of death, but given the large numbers found dead, we are treating it as suspicious." All wild birds are protected under the Wildlife and Countryside Act of 1981, and it is an offence to intentionally kill, injure or take them except under licence. And if found guilty, the maximum penalty is 6 months in prison and or an unlimited fine. Anyone caught deliberately using an airgun to injure an animal can face up to 5 years in prison and or an unlimited fine if found guilty under the Animal Welfare Act. RSPCA National Wildlife Coordinator Jeff Edmonds said, "It is unspeakably cruel, totally unacceptable and illegal to shoot animals for fun or as target practice, but sadly our emergency line is receiving hundreds of reports. We think of ourselves as a nation of animal lovers, but the RSPCA's experience shows that there are people out there who are deliberately targeting wildlife, pets and farm animals with guns, catapults and crossbows, and these weapons can cause horrific pain and suffering. Day after day our frontline officers and animal centres see the sickening consequences of weapons being used on animals with severe injuries, often leading to death. And what we deal with is probably only the tip of the iceberg, as not all cases will be reported to us directly, and there may be situations where animals injured and killed by these weapons are sadly never found, especially in the case of wildlife. Since the beginning of 2020 and up to May 2023, the RSPCA received 808 reports relating to animals being intentionally harmed with a weapon. Air guns and rifles were responsible for the bulk of the incidents, with 658 reports made to the charity. But weapons such as catapults and slingshots accounted for a combined 124 incidents, while there were 34 calls to the RSPCA about crossbow incidents. Terrible.
Yes, it's very sad. 500 years of black music and one of the UK's longest standing British Muslim communities are the focus of Norfolk exhibitions to mark Black History Month. The theme of this year's event is Reclaiming Narratives, with special exhibitions in Norfolk libraries. The Beyond the Baseline exhibition at Norwich's Millennium Library is a display documenting black music in Britain. Running from Tuesday 1st of October until Thursday 31st of October, the free exhibition is inspired by a British Library exhibition and explores how music acts as entertainment, but also as liberation, protest and education. The display spotlights clubs, carnivals and community hubs from across the country that have cultivated creative expression and inspired a number of black British music genres. The Millennium Library will also host an event called Black Futures, celebrating African and Caribbean heritage. Special guest is Norfolk-based novelist and poet Ashley Hickson-Lovins, who recently published his third novel, Wild East. The event runs from 7pm to 9pm on Wednesday, 23rd of October. It is free, but tickets must be booked online at www.eventbrite.co.uk/e/blackfuturestickets. Libraries all over Norfolk are celebrating Black History Month with special collections of books at Dereham, King's Lynn, Great Yarmouth, Thetford, North Walsham, Norwich Millennium Library, Galston and Wyndham, and a photography exhibition capturing community life among Norwich's Muslims will be displayed at North Walsham Library. Muslims Norwich, which premiered in the Museum of Norwich in Bridewell Alley earlier this year, features pictures photographer Khalil Mitchell has taken of his community, which meets at the Isan Mosque in Chapelfield East. The photographs chronicle life at the mosque during and after the coronavirus pandemic. The exhibition runs from Wednesday 25th of September until Wednesday 16th of October.
Norfolk's largest academy trust has ordered safety checks on almost half of its schools. The Diocese of Norwich Education and Academies Trust has called in surveyors to assess 18 of its sites with lath and plaster ceilings. It comes after three schools were forced to temporarily close earlier this term over safety issues with their aged classroom roofs. At the beginning of September, Fakenham Junior School and Reefham Primary School both had to shut to pupils while surveys were carried out. As a result, Norfolk County Council ordered checks on several of its maintained schools, which also saw Avenue Junior School in Norwich forced to close for 3 days. County Hall then urged Academy Trust to investigate the states of their own sites, particularly those containing lath and plaster ceilings. Oliver Burwood, Chief Executive Officer of the Diocese Trust, confirmed checks are set to be carried out in 18 of its schools. The organisation is responsible for 42 establishments in the county, more than any other trust, meaning almost half of its sites are affected. He said, "We have identified 18 of our 42 schools that either have or could have lath and plaster ceilings. I have written to parents of these schools saying that we had asked head teachers and site staff to visually check all ceilings and no issues were identified via this process." The Trust has also commissioned a specialist survey company to fully survey all ceilings in these 18 schools. Mr. Burwood continued, "We can then plan appropriate next steps based on the survey information, but will clearly prioritise the replacement of any ceilings that could cause issues in the short to medium term." Meanwhile, another of the Regent's Academy Trust, the Wensum Trust, has carried out checks on two of its 11 schools, but identified no safety issues.
A lifeboat was sent out late at night to bring a man ashore after he suffered a severe allergic reaction while working at sea. The man was on the Four Winds, a supply vessel which serves rigs and wind farm facilities, when he fell ill. The Caister Lifeboat Service was alerted at 11:05pm last Sunday, and at 11:17pm the ALB Bernard Matthews 2 was launched. It headed out to sea, reaching the Four Winds, 17 miles from shore, at 11:50pm. The man was taken on board the lifeboat and brought back to land, where he received hospital treatment. Guy Gibson, a member of the rescue crew, said, "The man was a member of a supply vessel and wasn't very well at all. He had bad chest pains, felt sick, and his throat was all swelled up. It was a severe allergic reaction. He wasn't even sure what had caused it. We got there as quickly as we could and waited for him while the ambulance was on the way when we got back. The man was then transported to James Paget Hospital by ambulance for further treatment."
Chaotic scenes last Sunday afternoon, which saw police attend a street fight and receive reports of a gunshot heard, are being treated as two separate incidents. Officers were called to Magnolia Green in Galston on Sunday, following reports of an incident in the street involving a group of males. One of them was carrying a knife and one was seen with an iron bar. A male aged in his late teens was taken to the James Paget Hospital in Galston with a head wound and a broken finger. Police have given an update on this incident. A spokeswoman for the force said, "A man in his 40s was arrested on suspicion of making threats to kill and was further arrested for grievous bodily harm. Both he and the male in his 20s have been released on bail until December the 19th, while inquiries continue. Officers believe all parties involved are known to each other." The sound of a gunshot was also reported to the police, and an air gun was subsequently seized from a property in Oak Road near to Magnolia Green where the fight was. Officers have now said, in regards to the Oak Road incidents, that a man in his 20s has been arrested on suspicions of firearm offences. He was taken to Great Yarmouth Police Station for questioning. Inquiries are continuing into both incidents, and the force has confirmed that they do not believe the incidents to be linked. Anyone with information is asked to contact Norfolk Police.
Animal activists have staged a protest calling for a ban on greyhound racing at the Great Yarmouth venue that holds them. The protesters were at Yarmouth Stadium holding various placards. The East Anglia branch of Action Against Animal Cruelty demonstrated outside the stadium at the Derby race meeting to encourage racegoers to reconsider supporting the sport. The group said they had a good amount of support from passing motorists, responding with a barrage of car horns to their placard, which read, "Hoot for the Hounds." A spokeswoman for the group said, "We believe that greyhound racing should be banned due to its inherent cruelty and the significant risks it poses to the dogs involved. The industry often involves unethical breeding practices, poor living conditions for the greyhounds, and a high rate of injuries and deaths during training and races. Additionally, the use of live baiting in some regions is particularly abhorrent. The pursuit of entertainment and gambling should not come at the expense of animal welfare." In a greyhound welfare section on the Yarmouth Stadium website, it describes how the animals are looked after. It says, "Greyhound racetracks give greyhounds the opportunity to continue their love of chasing in a safe environment." It adds how the dogs have to be inspected by a vet to ensure they are fit and healthy to compete following any injury, and that there is an on-course veterinary scheme. There is also a scheme to rehome the dogs when they have finished their racing careers. It adds, "At Yarmouth Stadium, welfare is and always has been our top priority."
A family-run restaurant, which closed down last year, could be transformed into housing. East Coast Restaurant on Scrappy Road in Ormsby. You might, some of you remember that as the Wheelstop Restaurant back in the 70s and 80s. Stopped trading in October 2023 due to rising costs and staffing issues. Now, Secure Tours Limited has lodged plans with Great Yarmouth Borough Council to change the use of the building to a single three-bedroomed house. The applicant is seeking prior approval for the application and said that all habitable rooms benefit from natural adequate light, and the proposal would likely result in decreased traffic. The planning application also states there is, quote, "sufficient room for parking and turning at the site." When the East Coast Restaurant closed in October last year, the owners said, "The last couple of years of rising costs and staffing issues had just felt like a relentless battle." The applicant, Secure Tours Limited, is based in Broadland Business Park in Norwich, and according to Companies House, it lets and operates real estate. A decision on the bid is expected by the 27th of September.
An award-winning soap star has been spotted enjoying a trip to Norfolk. James Farrar is best known for playing Sharon Watts' long-lost half-brother, Zach Hudson, in EastEnders. He joined the cast in 2021 and won Digital Spy's Best Soap Newcomer Award later that year. Fans might also recognise him for his portrayal of Liam Gilmore in Hollyoaks from 2011 to 2013. Locals saw Farrar out and about in Loddon on Saturday, and on Monday he tagged Fritton Lake in an Instagram story which showed him enjoying a gym workout. Fritton Lake is an exclusive holiday resort on the Norfolk-Suffolk border. The Telegraph previously described it as being fit for royalty. Guests can take a dip in the lake and explore the picturesque wildland and forestry nearby. The area is growing in diversity thanks to the site's impressive 1,000-acre rewilding scheme.
Good news for the town centre, hopefully, as one of the UK's biggest discount retail stores could move into a Great Yarmouth premises vacated by another chain which fell into administration last year. The Wilko branch in Great Yarmouth Marketgate Shopping Centre closed its doors for the final time last September, but now the vacant space could have a new lease of life 30 years after Wilko opened in 1994, after B&M expressed an interest to occupy the empty space. B&M have lodged a licence application, which is on display in the window of the shop unit, to Great Yarmouth Borough Council to serve alcohol between 7am and 11pm 7 days a week. A spokeswoman for Market Gates has said that the move is not yet confirmed, as an agreement is not yet finalised, though she has confirmed the chain's interest. Representations for or against the application can be lodged with the Borough Council in writing or by emailing licensing@great-yarmouth.gov.uk before October the 18th.
A mystery Norfolk man has bagged himself a life-changing pot of cash after a huge lottery win. The winner, known as Mr. M, became £1 million richer after playing the Euro Millions UK Millionaire Maker draw on 16th of August. The man, who played a personal selection of sentimental numbers via the National Lottery website, has become one of more than 8 million players who win each week. Winners have the opportunity to have their identity revealed or remain anonymous, like this mystery local. Andy Carter, senior winners advisor at the National Lottery, said, "What incredible news for Mr. M, who has become a millionaire overnight. Huge congratulations." The county has been on a lucky streak in recent months, with Mr. B scooping another £1 million jackpot in June. His first purchase was a pair of Levi jeans, and he also plans to use the winnings to buy a new Bentley and treat himself to dental implants so he can smile about the win.
You don't think Mr. B and Mr. M are the B and M who are going into Market Gates, do we?
No, going to cash in on the millions.
Hemsby escaped further erosion over the weekend following warnings of extremely high spring tides. The water was predicted to begin rising last week on Thursday, peak on Friday and stretch into Saturday. James Bensley, who represents the area on Great Yarmouth Borough Council, said the village was okay, but that they lost about another foot from Hemsby Gap. He also said a lot of material has moved from the coast to the north of the village, forming a sandbar, and that on Sunday, September the 22nd, you could walk out towards the shoreline for about 50 to 60 metres. This month, officers from the Borough Council have been visiting residents of houses closest to the sea on the Marrams and Fakes Road ahead of the winter, and the purpose of these visits is to establish an understanding of individual circumstances so the council is able to offer advice and appropriate support for residents. A total of 25 homes in Hemsby have been lost over the past 11 years due to erosion. Well, today I'm at Vision Norfolk here, and to talk to a good friend at Grapevine, it's Edward. Morning, Edward.
Hello, everybody. How are we? It's been a long while since I've been on here. It's nice to be back with you, though, Andrew.
Yeah, and joining us today with Edward is Matthew. Matthew is Edward's co-worker. Now, they're going to tell us about their recent epic adventure when they climbed Mount Snowdon. Now, this is not your average walk in the fresh air, is it, guys? Tell us all about this challenge.
Well, it started about year ago on and off.
Probably more than that.
Maybe a bit, yeah, actually, when you started. Matthew's only been with the association since about last June, haven't you? So
June 2023, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, 2023. I've known Matthew from a previous life, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
We were catching up, as you do, after a long while, and I'd just been told that I wasn't able to go to Everest Base Camp due to a health concern.
Everest was on the agenda then?
Yeah, well, a friend of mine was going to take an expedition of people up there. I was on that list to go, and I thought, well, I've never done anything like this before. I started training, and you have to go for medicals. He insisted that we all had a medical before the event, which is a very sensible.
Yeah, I would have said that's quite a good idea.
Yeah, and it turns out that... we know there's a history of heart problems in the family, and it turns out that I have a valve missing. So they were like, well, you're okay, but you probably shouldn't be climbing Everest. So as you can imagine, I was rather disappointed by this, obviously concerned about the more immediate health challenges, but more interested at that time thinking, well, what am I going to do in its place?
He was walking around looking like a horse with a long face. And I said to him, well, Ed, I said, just because you can't climb Everest, we'll find our own. How about we go and climb Snowdon? So, rather naively, I suggested that he and I would climb Snowdon, and we planned to do it in May.
Yeah, yeah.
And booked the hotel in January.
I started training after Christmas.
Yeah.
What did the training involve?
Well, for me, it involved like quite intense workouts at the gym, first of all. I went once, sometimes twice a week. So I had simulation of climbing hills on treadmills,
yeah.
But I also did some weight exercises as well. I carried weights in bags on my back.
Yep.
I did lots of exercises at home as well. So the gym instructor sent me lots of exercises to do at home to sort of like build me up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite muscly down on my legs, but my top half is a little not as muscly. So I wanted to develop that to make sure that I could actually cope with the physical endurance of climbing the mountain.
In the meantime, early in February, I had a mini stroke, which kind of scuppered our plans a little bit. But I was determined to get better, and we had a rethink and rescheduled to September.
Right.
In the meantime, my boss, Barbara Dunn, the services manager for Vision Norfolk, said that she felt that we shouldn't go alone and that she would come. Our colleague Helen King would also like to come, and our CEO Andrew Mortar would probably come. Andrew was always a probably, and so we'd rescheduled to September. I'd chosen Friday the 13th because I thought it would make the mountain a little bit quieter, which worked.
It did actually, didn't it?
And we planned. Because I'd had a mini stroke, I lost my driving license, so I spent the next 7 months cycling everywhere, cycling to work, cycling to visits, or catching the bus if the weather was inclement. But I cycled over 1,000 miles between April and September.
Right.
Many of those miles were work miles rather than just out for a jolly. So that's how I got fit. And roll forward to a few days before we actually went. Do you want to say what happened a few days before, Ed?
Well, which bit are you thinking of?
Ali.
Oh, well, yes. So we Matthew's wife had kindly agreed to drive Matthew and myself up there. The other three were going to travel separately simply because five people in a car with five sets of boots and mountain bags and plus overnight bags as well, because we had to stay over for 2 nights.
Of course.
We couldn't all fit in the one vehicle. Now, Matthew's wife, Ali, was going to come with us. She was going to come as one of the climbers. And she had also trained hard, hadn't she, Matthew?
Yeah.
But about 3 or 4 days before, she became unwell. I said to Mum, who's a fellow reader on Grapevine, I said, oh, Matthew's wife can't come. And Mum said as a sort of joke, well, if she can't drive, I'll take you up there. I don't think she was expecting, was she, Matthew, the day before, but we went. Phoning her up on the stage saying, you know, you said yesterday you'd be up for coming. Well, she was thrust in at the deep end. She didn't climb the mountain with us, I should point out, but she was an excellent...
part of the support team.
Oh, we wouldn't have managed without her, because Matthew and I would have struggled to have got up there, as I say, with all the stuff that we had to take. So After all, I did start to think, you know, should we even be doing this? Are all these things getting in the way and stopping us from doing it? But we set off about 2 weeks ago, and we had very good journeys. And at last, the moment had sort of arrived. Because for me, I was nervous. I'd not done anything like this before. And people had given me a lot of sort of horror stories about the weather closing in, about how difficult I'd find the climb, about how I might struggle to breathe. I mean, come on, this isn't Everest, is it? But when you're told things like that, you really don't want to hear that. And so I think, and also there have been quite a lot of fundraising as well, because we have done it as a fundraising challenge, haven't we, Matthew, for the association?
We have.
And so for me, there was quite a lot of pressure, because I wanted to get it right. I didn't want to let anybody down, and myself down, really, because I knew that I'd had the training, and I knew that I should be able to do it, but you know, things have a habit of happening. But I'm very glad to say, Matthew, finally, on Friday the 13th, about 9 o'clock in the morning, we parked at the base, Lamberis, because there's six different paths. And maybe you could explain what it was like as we walked up the mountain, Matthew. You could give a set a scene for the listeners.
So Lamberis was dry, bright, fine, little bit cool. And we parked in the car park opposite the Snowdon Mountain Railway Station, walked through the village quietly and respectfully, because it is somebody else's home.
I got told off for talking though loudly.
You were very loud.
Surprise.
And we were walking through a quiet section. And we started off up a tarmac lane, which
steepest I've ever climbed.
Very steep. Imagine Gas Hill and some. And it was very steep, very hard on the calves, and we started our way up. To begin with, Helen found it a little bit difficult, but after a short rest, she regained her composure. And once we were on the actual Lamberis path, it was nowhere near as steep as the tarmac lane that we've been on.
Can I ask, Matthew, is it organised when you get there, or do you just literally turn up and head for the summit? You don't have to...
It's a footpath.
You don't have to log in with anybody or anything? No?
You don't log in. The advice is that you have people who are not walking on the mountain, who know where you are, know which path you're taking, know when you expect to get down. I would advise that to anybody doing any outdoor walk, really, that you need to have somebody who knows where you're going, when you expect to be back. Because even if you're walking on the seafront, you know, and you've said that, you know, I'm going out for an hour. Well, if you're not back in 90 minutes, somebody will be worried about you.
Mm-hmm.
In wild country such as we were going to be walking, although it was busy, there we must have seen hundreds of people during the day climbing, but it was still important that somebody knew that we were going up, that we'd be at the top, and that we would be coming down. Something else that people need to know about Snowdon is you cannot walk up and catch the train down.
So if you walk up, you walk back.
You absolutely. Really?
There might be room on a train, but there is no guarantee of a space on the
train. There was no room on our day, was there?
No.
Not that we checked. But
And the Mountain Railway, if you buy a return ticket, you have to go up by train. You can't buy a return and only use one half. If your ticket's not validated on the way up, your ticket doesn't work to come down.
Right.
It's for them to protect their numbers,
I think. Yeah, of course.
Mm.
But, yeah, we saw plenty of people using the train. The atmosphere once we got to the summit was very friendly. What was happening was as groups got to the summit, which is a small round plinth about 3.5 foot tall, which is where people have their summit photos taken, quite often it was the group behind you that would be taking your photos, or you would wait and you would take their photos for them. And that's exactly what happened for us. And a couple in their 60s who were just behind us, we walked past them earlier during the walk, took our photos. But not only did they do that, we sort of lost touch with them at the summit. They took our photos, we took theirs, etc., etc. We went into the cafe for a bit of nourishment. But later in the day, they sponsored us with the comment, "We saw you twice on the mountain. You're an inspiration, Edward. Here's some money." And to date, we've raised about £3,600 of our £5,000 target.
Really is, it really tremendous. Is. So you've spoken to us of going straight to the summit. Halfway up, were they stopping? Did you need to stop, or were you just slogging it out?
I did. We did stop.
We stopped often.
Often on the way
which
up.
Which was good.
Yeah.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about the path, because Matthew had explained eloquently about the steep lane. But I wanted to explain about the mountain path that we climbed on after we got up the steep hill. And this was effectively big rocks, shale and gravel. Clearly an attempt had been made to make a sort of legible path, if you like, for people to go up. And so obviously, you know, like for me and the person who was assisting, because everybody swapped round taking me because everybody else on the group was sighting, it must have been a bit of a challenge doing it if you're... I mean, all of the staff here are very used to working and assisting people with sight loss. But it can't have been easy because you have to focus on where you're putting your own feet as well as helping somebody else. I held on to somebody. We had a lot of different tools that we used for me to hold on to climb up the mountain. And in the end, we decided that the bog standard way of guiding, so holding on somebody's elbow, was actually the best way for me. I held on to that person on one side and I used my cane on the other side to pick up any trip hazards that would be not detected by the guide. And I say that worked quite well, really, for all of us.
As a guide, it was hard work because you were taking in the scenery, looking at the path ahead, assisting Ed, audio describing what was going on, and audio describing where we're putting our feet, but also audio describing, you know, oh, there's a sheep to our left. And Ed would say things like, are we going next to a wall? And I'd say, no, it's a sheer, you know, it's a sheer face rock to our left. Or, we never needed, you know, climbing gear. So it wasn't ropes and crampons like that. It was a walk. It was a very tough walk. I would advise anybody considering doing it, they need to have good physical health. It's not something that you could do if you're frail. It was very hard on the knees coming down.
Oh, for
very,
coming down was
hard.
Worse.
It was really? The hardest, yeah.
Yeah.
If you're scared of heights like me, there are bits where you don't want to be stood too near the edge. But otherwise, it was fine. We did have one or two little hiccups along the way. I got terrible earache, which cleared when we got higher up. So I think it was a case of atmospheric pressure.
What height are we at now, say, halfway up?
So halfway would be a roughly 1,800 metres.
And for those, I mean, living in Norfolk, that is, you know, we're not
that's
used
high.
To anything like that, are we?
No.
It's really, really high.
Yeah. If you think Cromer Church Tower is about 100 metres, I think. 100 feet.
Yeah.
Yeah, about 100 feet. So it's about 30 metres. So what are we talking about? 10... about 120 times that.
Yeah. Wow.
That puts it in perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah, 3,600 feet or thereabouts.
Wow.
To the
3,600 metres
yeah.
or thereabouts. Yeah. So, yeah, quite high. No snow. When we were at the summit, a large dark cloud came across to the summit. And we thought, oh, it would, you know, the summit's going to disappear in cloud. And it didn't. It came up and it went round the top of the mountain and went off to the south.
Yeah.
So we never got enshrined in cloud. So that was really good.
So you're comfortably warm at this point, are you?
I was too hot. I didn't even wear my coat all day. I wore a top and a body warmer. I had a coat in the bag, obviously, which I bought specifically for the challenge and still haven't worn.
Well, you're saving that for Everest, though, aren't you?
Oh, of course, yeah.
I'd worn the base layer that I wear when I'm motorcycling, and I'd put waterproof walking trousers over the top of that, and a hoodie and a coat, and I always wear a hat. And we hadn't got very far when I'd whipped off my trousers, so I was basically walking in what looked like leggings. And hoodie, and that was enough. Yeah.
So that's a combination of obviously the sunshine and sheer physical exertion.
And the effort, yeah.
Yeah.
And there were times when the Lamberis path that we walked, once you've got past the halfway cap, probably 300 or 400 metres further up, it takes quite a turn to the left, a 90 degree to the left, and that's because it sort of connects with the valley, and the wind that cut across that valley, coat back on. But that was the day. It was warm enough at times that you didn't need a coat on, and other times. I'm always a shirt cooler than most people, so I was, coat on, coat off.
So, time to get to the top? How long did it take you?
Total time, Ed? Was
about 4.5 hours to get up to the top.
Well, it was about 9 hours in total. I think
that's a big old day, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is. Much quicker coming down, but much harder coming down for me, me personally. Others may disagree.
Yeah.
But we took much fewer breaks on the way down. I think we just thought, let's carry on walking. And on the way down, I thought, no, I'm not going to sit down in case I can't get up again, because the backs of my legs were beginning to ache.
Yeah.
So when we left the cafe, I thought, I'm not sitting down again until we're back in the car, driving back to the hotel. And we just walked back on the way down. So probably we had about a half hour to an hour's wait at the top for the photos, would you say?
No. For the photos, we probably only waited 10 or 15 minutes at the most. We weren't in much of a queue, but we then went into the cafe, we used the toilet, we had a hot chocolate and you had a pasty.
I had a pasty, and it was very nice.
Good.
So, and the cafe's run by Snowdon Mountain Railway.
Really?
Yeah.
How many litres of water did they take up a day?
They take up 9,000 litres of drinking water a day.
Yeah.
Because obviously the toilets and things all run off that. They take all the diesel out there for the generator because it's not on the
grid.
Everything goes up by train, everything. So from a packet of Polo mints to 9,000 litres of water, all goes up by Snowdon Mountain Railway.
And obviously the weather would close the mountain if it's too inclement, but otherwise it's open.
Yeah.
Well, and there's no barriers, so if you decided you were going to walk up there in a gale and a blizzard, you could. I would not recommend it.
I wouldn't fancy
The railway shuts if the weather's inclement. So the railway say it's two things. One, getting up there, but two, the safety of getting people back down.
Yes.
So if the weather's really bad, they don't run. And the railway is quite interesting in that it has three rails. Two for the wheels, and the one in the middle is toothed, so that the trains pull themselves up by a gear engaging with teeth in the middle of the track,
rather than a motor to
drive it. Rather than just puff. Or no cables and water weights and things like that. Yeah.
So a sense of elation when you made the summit then.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
After all that build up, and it did show me what training could do. As Matthew stated at the beginning, he was a bit later starting because of his health problems, but made up the time for me, because I was able to start in January and focus on my progress. It did make me realise how good it was to have that fitness, and how important it was, and how important it was to be sensible about what you ate as well, but still having a good time. And it was just nice to think that I got there, because as I said, I've been quite put off by what people had said about the challenge. And that's not always healthy. It's good to be realistic, but I think some people who said it probably hadn't even been up there before.
Yeah. The naysayers said, that we would get wet, that we'd be on our hands and knees scrabbling, that we would, we'd probably want to catch a train. There was a lot of naysaying. But there were other people who'd done it and said, you're up for this, this is good, you'll really enjoy it.
And we did.
It'll be good for you. And it was good. And, I'd like to particularly say thank you to Barbara and Helen and Andrew, because certainly Andrew's Flapjacks got us there and back.
They were incredible.
And Andrew bakes, and he baked us Flapjacks, which definitely helped. They were the sugar rush we needed from time to time. But Barbara's determination,
Helen's experience,
Helen's
and fitness.
Companionship. Helen and Barbara had done it before. And Barbara had always said, never, ever again, till we decided we were going, and she knew that we would need help. Glad that I listened to her.
We just didn't know.
No.
And for me, if we're sticking on this trip, obviously all four of the sighted people for me, because without the four of them, I would not have been able to have done this challenge. I would not have, I'd have been able to probably plan it, but I would not have had a clue what it was like up there. I would not have managed to have got up there myself. And like I said a few minutes ago, I think helping someone else up these sort of difficult walks must be quite tricky. I can't obviously speak from experience because I've not assisted anybody else, but I think it must be tricky. So all four of them were really helpful. And yeah, I definitely know that I would not have managed it on my own.
That's a great team effort. I've got to ask then, the next day, how were the limbs?
Oh, painful.
Mine were particularly bad when we got back home. So
because then you obviously had a long car journey, haven't you? Well, which didn't do you good, did it?
When I got back into the house, I thought, I'll unpack everything. And I put a load of washing on, and I made a cup of tea, and I did some stuff in the garden. And I thought, I'm not going to sit down until I have to, because if I sit down, I may not manage to get up. So, like, I literally did everything standing up until about 9:30, where I thought, yes, I'm definitely ready. And then I sat down. But the Saturday night for me was probably the worst. By the Sunday, I felt near enough back to normal.
Yep.
Yeah. Sunday, I was out on my push bike again, and that didn't hurt. But walking, getting up from sitting down, did hurt. I'm 61, so I'm not a spring chicken. But the backs of my calves and my left thigh were what really hurt. And probably by Monday evening, I was okay.
That's good. That's good. So I've got to ask as well: is there another challenge on the horizon? Then there's this spurge. Wow. You can do something else.
I've already written out the proposal. I've done this before, probably about three times, but I've suggested to Ed that we jump on a tandem and whiz round the outside of Norfolk, which is about 212, 220 miles, and would take us about 3 and a bit days. With 4 days. We could do it in 4 days. And I've written up a proposal looking at where we'd go. There's really good routes. There's the North Norfolk cycle route and the Two Rivers cycle route, which pretty much meet each other, and will take us right round the county. So that's a plan for next year.
I think so. I think there might be some very different training involved for that.
I think there might be, but that's a marvellous plan for next year. But we can only say well done on a marvellous effort, both of you, and thank you for sharing this story with us. And let's hope you hit that £5,000 target as well.
Thank you. And
thank you. You can find us on Just Giving.
Yes, you can. And I'd like to thank your support of Grapevine as well for giving us two chances to talk about this. We spoke about this, February time?
We did, yeah.
And it seemed a lot. I think it was just before Matthew was ill. So it seemed like it was coming around quite quickly. And then obviously the delay. And now here we are on the other side. So yeah, thank you for your support. And I hope the listeners enjoyed listening.
I'm sure they will.
Thank
Matthew,
you.
Matthew, Ed, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, Andrew.
Climb every mountain, search high and low, follow every byway, every path you know.
appropriate for Snowdon, the very Welsh Shirley Bassey, and Climb Every Mountain. OK, last part of this week's news now, so back to Andrew.
Vapes and e-cigarettes were stolen during a break-in at Caister Post Office. Norfolk police were called to the post office on Yarmouth Road in the village at 3:18 a.m. on Thursday, September the 19th, following reports of a burglary. Officers attended the scene where it was believed two suspects forced entry overnight and took a number of vapes and e-cigarettes. A spokesperson for Norfolk Police said that inquiries are ongoing. A Norfolk Broad spot with picturesque views is on the hunt for a new caterer. The Toadhole Cottage at Howe Hill near Ludham is looking to open a mobile cafe to serve hot drinks and snacks. Howe Hill is known for its thatched house and surrounding woodland and marshland, which are popular for nature walks and family picnics. It has free 24-hour moorings for around 30 hire and privately owned boats, as well as a car park and public toilets. Toadhole Cottage is searching for a caterer to sell hot drinks, sandwiches and cakes from a mobile unit, such as a trailer or a converted horse box. The Broads Authority, quote, envisage a suitable food offering would be cakes, tray bakes, warmed pastries and paninis, rather than deep-fried food. The pitch itself is in the gardens of Howe Hill, right next to the picnic field and riverside moorings. People interested in taking on the pitch should apply to the Broads Authority by October the 30th. A bid to convert a cottage into part of a children's care home in Filby Village has been refused. Clifford Rapley from Reedham was seeking permission from Great Yarmouth Borough Council to change the use of Pear Tree Cottage on Main Road in Filby. The building is a three-bedroom cottage attached to one wing of Filby Hall, which operates as a children's home. Mr. Rapley was applying for a certificate of lawful proposed use, which would mean he would not need full planning permission. In the planning application, he referred to a statement made by Rachel McLean, former Minister of State for Housing and Planning, to the House of Commons last year. At the time, Ms. McLean said the planning system, quote, should not be a barrier to providing homes for the most vulnerable children in society. But planners said the proposal was not permitted development and would require planning permission. Filby Parish Council objected to the application, stating there was a lack of secured outside space. They also said the building was not suited for the stated purpose, as it is a Grade 2 listed building and would require considerable modification. The proposed facility is close to a playing field and village school, which may not be suitable for the type of secure facility that is being described, the Parish Council added. According to the proposals, the building was to function as a proper long-term home for a young person. Planners said the proposed use was considered laudable, but it required planning permission. They also said the application was not supported by information as to why the applicant considered that the change of use from a dwelling to a children's home did not require planning permission. At an Ofsted inspection in February, Filby Hall's children home was rated inadequate. A man has died after suffering a medical emergency on the Norfolk Broads. Emergency services were called to Bridge Road in Potterheim at 4:45 p.m. on Tuesday and found a man in the water. A spokesman for Norfolk Constabulary said that despite the best efforts of those at the scene, the man in his 60s was pronounced dead. His next of kin have been informed. A holidaymaker, who does not want to be named, said he saw four or five people jump in to save the man. Two ladders were also put into the water by a local boat firm, he explained. It's a shocking thing to see when you're on holiday. The incident happened close to Herbert Woods' boatyard, near to the bridge over the River Thurn. Herbert Woods did not want to comment on the incident. A fourth-generation printing business, owned by the brothers who discovered a 17th-century royal shipwreck, dubbed Norfolk's Mary Rose, has gone into liquidation. Barnwell Print, based in Aylsham and owned by avid divers Julian and Lincoln Barnwell, entered voluntary liquidation last week. The business has been in the Barnwell family for 115 years, but has struggled since the pandemic due to rising costs. Joint Managing Directors Julian and Lincoln are known in Norfolk for their discovery of HMS Gloucester, which sank off the coast of Great Yarmouth in 1682, with James Stuart, the Duke of York, and the future King James II on board. Around a dozen staff were made redundant at Barmal on Friday, and some had worked there for 30 years. The Barmal print business has now been taken over by former competitor Micropress Printers, based in Raydon, Suffolk. Barmwell's 12,000 square foot unit at Aylsham's Dunkirk Industrial Estate was listed as available for long-term lease by estate agent Brown & Co. back in August, which raised suspicion among staff. However, it was only on Friday when they learned the news. One worker, who asked to remain anonymous, said, "It really is a blow for a lot of people who have been there for so many years." The Aylsham site will remain open in the short term, with the business's production capabilities and customers being transferred over to Micropress. Both Julian and Lincoln Barmwell and Richard Pryor, a long-serving manager, are all set to continue working at the Aylsham site, which will now be operated by Micropress. Julian Barmwell said, "Coming out of the pandemic with lower sales, entering a period of higher costs with an energy crisis, and still trying to operate in a very competitive market with reduced margins has sadly proved to be too much. However, we see Micropress as an excellent fit for us with their modern equipment, continued multi-million pound investment and strong position in the marketplace. Up until now, they were one of our biggest competitors, so we know how good they are. Joining forces with them makes us more competitive with better systems, but we keep that personal and knowledgeable Barmwell print contact with our customers, which they are accustomed to and appreciate." Micropress is owned and run by two brothers, James and Rob Cross, and their father Mike is chairman of the company. The Suffolk firm have been looking to expand its business into Norfolk, and absorbing its former rival Barmwell is considered to be the first step in achieving this. However, Micropress want to move the office closer to Norwich and set up a Norfolk hub, and Barmwell's Aylsham unit is still listed as available for lease for £50,000 per year, which works out at £4,167 per month. Rob Cross, Micropress Joint Managing Director, said, "We're excited to welcome Barmwell print customers to the Micropress family. As we are also a carbon balanced printer, we share a commitment to delivering high quality, sustainable print solutions and exceptional customer service combined with competitive pricing. We look forward to serving Barmwell print customers and building strong, lasting partnerships." The Barmwell brothers have said all existing customers' artwork files are being retained and reprint orders and regular work can be replaced. Lincoln Barmwell added, "On behalf of Julian and myself, I would like to extend our sincere gratitude to the employees of Barmwell Print Limited, both present and past, for their unwavering support of the business over the years. Their dedication and hard work have been the backbone of the company's longevity and success. We are also very appreciative of our long-standing loyal customers and suppliers." Low attendance at the Great Yarmouth Arts Festival has been blamed on people preferring TV over going out. The events took place from September the 13th to the 22nd at venues across the borough, and while the carnival parade on Saturday, September the 21st was deemed a success, organisers were disappointed at, quote, "the poor turnout at many of the events." Hugh Sturziker, the festival chair, said, "People seem to prefer to sit in front of their televisions rather than going out." The festival saw events take place at the Minster, on the seafront, and in St George's Park, among other locations, with concerts, talks and exhibitions. Mr Sturziker said that attending the festival would be better for people's mental health. He admitted that cost may be a factor in the low turnout, but said it is so important for one's mental health and physical health to get out and meet people. "By going to meetings and concerts, people meet up with friends or make new ones, and this is very good for their mental health. It also gives them exercise," he said. Already many organisations are suffering with poor attendances and some have closed.
The Arts Festival Carnival took place on Saturday, September the 21st. Mr. Sturzaker said it was a joyous and colourful occasion, thanks to a small group of enthusiasts led by Pat Howe and Julie Stimpson, and supported by a grant from the National Lottery Community Fund. The festival also provided a range of musical events, culminating in the East Coast Sinfonietta, who played George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow, Beethoven's Violin Concerto, and Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony. In addition, there were two tribute bands in St George's Theatre and a guitar extravaganza with Captain Calamity performing his magic for young children. Breakdancing was performed in front of the Britannia Pier after several classes had been held in the previous weeks. If anyone is interested in helping out with next year's Arts Festival, please check its website, which is greatyarmouthartsfestival.co.uk. A man caught red-handed selling drugs by undercover police officers was doing so to help pay fines imposed for previous offences, a court was told. Michael Semedo, aged 29, was spotted by officers interacting with addicts in Sackville Cross, Great Yarmouth, in a known hotspot for drug dealing. Norwich Crown Court heard that as police approached Semedo, he ran, prompting a pursuit during which he, quote, discarded something from his pocket. Oliver Haswell, prosecuting, said when stopped, Semedo was found with a number of wraps of controlled drugs, as well as £160 in cash. Mr. Haswell said the cocaine and heroin found amounted to 97 street deals. Semedo had a number of compensation orders, as well as a large amount of costs imposed on him following a magistrate's court hearing in May. This followed an earlier conviction for charges including assaulting an emergency worker and assault with intent to resist arrest. The court this week was told Semedo, who had a Portuguese interpreter, had been selling drugs on July the 2nd to earn cash to pay off the debt. Semedo of Devonshire Road in Yarmouth admitted possession with intent to supply heroin and cocaine. Jailing him for a total of 3 years, Judge Andrew Shaw said he was caught red-handed with a substantial quantity of cocaine and heroin. He said selling controlled drugs of Class A is so serious only an immediate sentence of imprisonment can be justified. Judge Shaw also warned Semedo he should not, in future, commit criminal offences to try and pay court costs. John Morgan's mitigating said those on the front line of drug supply, the foot soldiers, were, quote, highly visible and highly disposable. He said Semedo, who has spent time in custody away from his partner and two young children, has also received a serious diagnosis regarding his health. He said Semedo was ashamed to play a role in the misery he sees around him in custody. Now, this is news of a good old friend of Grapevine here, and this Saturday will be a special one for a 90-year-old Norfolk man as he returns to watch his beloved football team for the first time in 74 years. Yeah, it's Malcolm Metcalf, and Malcolm first started watching Galston in 1949. He's been a lifelong supporter of the club, and now he's gearing up to cheer them on once again. His love for the Greens began when he was just a teenager. After attending several matches, he was asked to sell 1p on the ball tickets at home games, a competition where the winner received the match ball. His dedication to the club was clear, and in August 1950, aged just 16, he became the youngest committee member on the Galston FC Supporters Club. In the early 1950s, Galston drew large crowds with over 2,000 fans regularly attending games. One of Malcolm's most cherished memories is Galston's FA Cup run in 1950-51, when they defeated Romford 1-0, went on to draw against Leighton Orient, setting up a thrilling replay at Highbury, where Galston narrowly lost 5-4. After travelling the world, which of course we know lots about, a feat which saw him earn the nickname the Michael Palin of Galston, and taken on other commitments, Malcolm hasn't had the chance to see his team play in recent decades. But now, as Galston prepare for a home clash against St Albans City
at Great Yarmouth's Wellesley Ground on Saturday, he'll once again be in the stand shouting, "Come on the Greens!" "I can't wait to see them play again," he said. "It'll be great to see a large crowd come out to support the team." And as we all know, last year Malcolm completed a challenge which over the course of 7 months saw him enjoy 90 new activities before his 90th birthday, all in aid of the Priscilla Bacon Hospice. Hope you have a great day there, Malcolm. More changes at Norfolk's tips have sparked anger, with small traders warning they could have to pass on fees to get rid of trade waste to customers. Norfolk County Council is changing how much it charges businesses to get rid of rubbish such as garden waste, rubble, scrap metal, plasterboard and timber at the 7 recycling centres which accept it. And companies offering services such as gardening, landscaping and house clearances say they could go under or have to pass extra costs on to customers. While the council charges for the disposal of such trade waste, at the moment it is calculated per bag. But from November, it will be done according to the size of vehicles and how full they are. Small traders, who already have to pay for licences to be permitted to dispose of waste, say that will be more expensive than the current system. They say they are likely to have to pay £323 to get rid of a mixed load in a large van. It will coincide with a controversial new system where people will have to book timed slots to get rid of waste at the county's recycling centres. Centres are also being shut on Wednesdays to save county hall money. Norfolk businesses have warned they could go under. LS Landscapes Garden and Waste Removal posted on Facebook, "We don't want to raise our prices, especially with how the UK economy currently is, and of course cost of living. But unfortunately it's between two choices, raise our prices or close our doors. So we're going to test it for a month or two and see how well we can do. But please be aware prices will be raised in order to keep running. And if it's not manageable, then unfortunately it'll be time to close up shop." A Norfolk County Council spokeswoman said, "We are not changing our prices significantly, rather changing the way we charge." She said the changes were a more accurate way of assessing loads, and vehicles up to 50% full would get a discount. She said the prices are based on actual costs for processing the waste on site, haulage and disposal of materials, and are similar to those charged through Suffolk's Trade Waste Service. The move to charging by vehicle size aims to make sure that disposal costs of trade waste are fully covered in Norfolk. This is expected to save the County Council £200,000 in waste disposal costs, which are not being covered by the current bag system of charging for trade waste. She said private companies also offer trade waste disposal services. The controversy comes at a time when small businesses have been turned away from council recycling centres. Liberal Democrat councillor Dan Roper raised the issue at this week's meeting of Norfolk County Council. He said one Norwich trader was told they would have to travel to Thetford because waste could not be accepted at the city's tips. Council bosses said they had been forced to, quote, turn off trade waste services because so much waste was being taken to tips. One spokeswoman said, "Our recycling centre service has seen particularly high demand over recent weeks as a result of changes in DIY waste legislation in January, alongside a wet start to the year producing extra green garden waste, meaning that tonnage has increased by around 12.5%. Alongside this, there have been some logistical issues to manage, which included a shortage of drivers over the holiday period. Unfortunately, to protect the service for household customers, we've had to turn off the trade waste service for short periods at all of our sites that offer this service. Providing a trade waste service at recycling centres is discretionary, and not all councils do it. Household waste is our priority at the recycling centres, but we do wish to offer a service to traders alongside this, and we are very sorry for the inconvenience this disruption has caused." The council said sites were now accepting trade waste again, except Caister, which is still struggling with capacity issues.
that's it for this week's edition, which is copyright 2024 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Don't forget you can contact us from our website at grapevinegy.org if you have any queries over our service. Your newsreader next week will be Andy, so we hope for your company then for much more of your local news. In the meantime, from all of us here at Grapevine, stay safe and well, and bye for now.